Hey, Reggie, what's going on, my friend? I'll have a little podcast action today. What do you say? I'm in the mood. Why don't you get in the mood, all right? Let's do this thing. Get that trigger finger ready and put it in the books, episode 522. And I'll give you three S's, and we'll do a countdown, and I'll give you a podcast, okay? All right, here we go. Star, smile, strong. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Of course, it's always important to listen, but it's just as important to get out there and tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Of course, if you enjoy what you're listening to and you want to hear maybe some older podcasts that we've done, we've been around for a while, always go to WGNRadio.com. Go to the podcast section, hit the prompt for Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and there you will find dozens and dozens and dozens of previous podcasts just waiting for you to enjoy, to either remember or to experience for the first time. We've been doing this for a while. In fact, not only is this episode 522, but it has now been 10 years for this podcast. Started in May of 2016, May 24th, exactly. And so this week, we celebrate our 10th anniversary. I'll have a little more to talk about that later, but 522 and 10 years and counting. Let's continue. So, I don't know if you've been watching the news lately, but or at least online. It's hard to tell anymore what's the news and what's online or what's social media. There really isn't any demarcations anymore. It is, did you hear, right? I don't know what you even say. When someone says, did you see the news? Did you hear the news? In the past, there were X amount, a finite number for the most part, of areas of where you would have seen that or heard it. You would have read it in a newspaper. You would have seen it on television, or you would have heard it on the radio. Those were the big three. Well, now, of course, all bets are off. The big three are just barely surviving. They're not big anymore. Those three are still around, but they're certainly not as dominant as they used to be. And while social media certainly is a dominant source of information for especially younger people, I would say under 40, radio and television and newspapers are still in the mix. They're still there. In fact, a sizable amount of people still listen, certain or watch or read, but it's certainly now definitely divided into age groups. No question about that. People probably in their 50s and older still maybe cling to those platforms or those media sources that they used to, in terms of newspapers, radio, and television. And of course, everybody, I mean, you could almost say that everybody to some extent has been forced to dip their toe into the internet and social media and smartphone world. Some people are certainly much more obsessed with it, more savvy with it, more in tune to it. Those tend to be the younger people who grew up with it. Older generations, older people had to find a way to insert that or merge that into their lifestyles after decades of having, as I said, newspapers, television, and radio. But I would say at this point, did you hear, did you see, did you read? That could be anywhere, which is kind of scary because at least there was some semblance of, and I've talked about this in the past, there's been some semblance of reliability in at least the legacy medias. To some extent, nothing's perfect. Everything's made by a human. But at least there were, stages of viability or validity in each one's editing, checking, and things like that. Today, you know, the internet is, and social media is pretty much just one big gossip column, just one big water cooler, people spreading news without really checking it out. But that's the world we're in. That's the world we're in, and I guess we just have to be a little more diligent. But for those of us who actually try to look at things with a different viewpoint rather than just hearing about something and spreading it out or make some observations, for those of us, you know, we still rely on all aspects of information gathering and dispensing. And so, yeah, I mean, I still read newspapers, still listen to radio, still watch television for my news, and certainly get it online as well. That's in magazines, too. They're all part of the mix. The mix has changed. It used to be called a marketing mix. That's what they called it, in academic circles, in marketing classes. The marketing mix. Well, the marketing mix has shifted, but it's still there. And some of the old ingredients remain. They're just not used as much as they used to be, at least by, as I said before, a certain part of the population. But this short little media lesson has absolutely nothing to do with what I want to talk about today. Well, maybe it does. We'll see. There's always a connection, folks, believe me. But I do want to, I don't know if you've seen or heard or read or experienced, I don't know. But lately in the news, to get back to what I was originally talking about, undoubtedly you've read or seen or heard that a lot of some of the legendary music stars of the last 50 and, yes, even 60 years, bordering on, almost 70 years when you think about some of the ages of these people, you're seeing some of these names that have been around literally since the mid to late 60s, people like Paul McCartney and Pete Townsend and Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and then moving into the 70s with people and Paul Simon, and then people moving into the 70s like people like Bruce Springsteen and Barry Manilow and Elton John, of obviously part of this podcast is named after, right? But many of the aging rock stars and pop stars from the 60s and 70s who are now well into their 80s, early to mid 80s. Ringo Starr, I believe, just turned, I think he's 85. He might be turning 86. I think his birthday is sometime in July. This is quite a phenomenon in the historical aspect. Rock and roll was supposed to be a fad back in the 50s with Elvis. And yet those who professed it and were loyal to it and who were making rock, of course, there's a 50s song called Rock and Roll Is Here to Stay. Long Live Rock by The Who. Oh, yes, there's been many different viewpoints of rock and roll. It was a musical revolution, but it also sparked a cultural revolution and a behavioral revolution. And while it's still around today, and I've talked about this in the past, it's still around today, it certainly is not the dominant music anymore. Obviously, it's rap and hip-hop and pop in general, and a different kind of pop. Your Taylor Swift's, your Dua Lipa's, your Chappell Roan's, your Beyoncé's, it's very heavily female-oriented in today's world, as well as dance-oriented and rap and hip-hop. Rock and roll still exists, but it's really an old person's game. And basically, it's still the same old people who at one time were saying, I hope I die before I get old. Who at one time were in their brash early 20s and who were disparaging the music of the day, the established music, the old people's music, the old cronies' music, the Dean Martins and the Tony Bennett's and the you know, that whole crowd, right? And the Frank Sinatras, of course, who perhaps the greatest of all the crooners and the most legendary. But that was being poo-pooed by this new brash, cool, hip, rocking sound. And of course, the old guard, the Sinatras and the Dean Martins and the Tony Bennett's, they were a little, you know, skeptical. They made fun of it. Steve Allen, the first host of the Tonight Show back in the 50s, actually, excuse me, used to do a comedy bit when rock and roll first started by, you know, of course, there were some of the great lyricists in the 20s and 30s and 40s and early 50s, like, you know, George and Ira Gershwin and Johnny Mercer and Sammy Kahn and some of these other, these noted songwriters. And they were writing songs about love and life in general. And rock and roll was more about a spirit. It was more about a feeling. And nobody perhaps expressed that feeling better, that rock and roll rebellious just feel, not any specific, not any kind of specific experience of love or experience of disappointment like the lyricists of the 40s and 50s would write about so beautifully and lovely. Don't get me wrong. Some of those songs of the past are beautifully written and beautifully turned phrases. And I appreciate those as much as anything else. But rock and roll was different. It was breaking the mold, and it was about feeling, but raw feeling. And so, as I said before, Steve Allen did this joke or this little bit about analyzing the lyrics to some of the popular rock and roll songs of the day. And, of course, he was mocking it, making fun of it. As most people, when rock first came, it, as I said, it looked as it like it was going to be just another fad. And those... in you know those people that were moving the culture at that time, like your Dean Martins and your Frank Sinatras and your Steve Allens, who was the host of the Tonight Show, just like Johnny Carson or in today's world Steve Colbert or Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon or people like that, who just by their positions of in these entertainment shows are given instant credibility. Well, Steve Allen had that same kind of credibility that, say, a Steve Colbert would have. And many people listen to him, and of course, this is, in fact, this last week was Colbert's last week, and perhaps the Late Show franchise in general on CBS may be gone. But my point is that there was some credibility here, and it was the establishment making fun of these young, silly youths who thought that they were going to topple the establishment. You know, that's whatever happens in anything, whether it's government or cultural things. The establishment never thinks that these rebels, these revolutionaries, these ragtag groups who are just revolting will ever amount to anything. And a lot of times they don't, but every so often they do. And it's a total game change and shift change. And that's what happened with rock and roll. But as I said, Steve Allen, for instance, you can go online and find this. You can go online on Google and say, you know, Steve Allen making fun of Little Richard and making fun of songs like Beep Bop Alula or Tutti Frutti, Oh Rudy, A Womp Bomb Alubom, A Womp Bam Boom. Nothing describes rock and roll better than Little Richard and that line. That line, when you want to say, what is rock and roll? Yes, I know you can go through the annals and you can look at Elvis and you can look at Jerry Lee Lewis and you can look at Chuck Berry. And I am not denigrating or putting down anything of those people and any others of there because I'm a fan of all of theirs and I respect all of them. But when it comes to me, the essence of rock and roll, the essence of conveying what rock and roll is, if 100 years from now, someone said, well, what's this rock and roll thing? I've been reading about it, and apparently it was some big deal. Because believe me, 100 years from now, rock and roll is going to be like, well, what's this classical music thing? What's this jazz thing? What's this? What was this big band thing? Oh, it'll still be around, and it will stand some of the test of time, because it was such a dominant force for at least 30 or 40 years, much longer than many of the other musical phrases. I mean, we still have classical music around. They still exist. But at one time, classical music was the music. At one time, big band music was the music. At one time, rock and roll was the music. It is no longer the music. It is around, but it doesn't dominate anymore. And as I said, the only reason why it's even prominent anymore is because of people who are still around, still practicing the craft, even in their 80s, even though they mocked those people that at that time were only in their 40s and 50s. They were calling them old. And now they are twice their age, and they won't leave the stage. But if you asked, if 100 years from now or 200 years from now, if somebody would ask, well, what was this rock and roll thing? I would put forth to anybody who's going to be around in 200 years, make sure you listen to, give them Tutti Frutti. Give them Little Richard's Tutti Frutti. And let them hear a wop bomba loo bomb, a wop bam boom, because that's rock and roll. That is a rebellious and energized and youthful and exhilarating expression of freedom that, when picked apart, makes no sense. But when listened to in the context, explains rock and roll. A wop bomb, a loo bomb, a wop bam boom. That's rock and roll. That's what it is. It breaks the mold. It is a pure release of all those things I just talked about. A pure release of emotion, a pure release of expression, a pure release of excitement, a pure release of rebellion. It can't make sense. It shouldn't make sense. That's what the older people in the 50s didn't understand. They were looking at this and saying, well, this doesn't make sense. Wop, bop, a loo, bop, a wop. You know, so Steve Allen would go, so let's look at the lyrics of some of these popular songs. Beep, bop, a lula, she's my baby. A wop, bop, a loo, bop, a wop, bam, boom. Oh, the crowd, everybody was laughing hysterically. How silly all this is. Because they weren't understanding the underlying context of it. It was a battle cry. It was an anthem of rebellion, of pure expression, of saying what you feel in a repressed era, especially during the Eisenhower years of the 50s. Repressed era, people all trying to be the same. And the youth of the day, for whatever reason, after years of the youth following suit of the older generation and becoming mini adults, for some reason, whether it was post-World War II, whether it was the fear of the realization of the horrors of World War II and how life was short, or how life in many cases was not valued, people said, you know what, we're living for the moment. We're going to be who we want to be. And that was the battle cry. That wop bomb a loo bomb, a wop bam boom, that was the shot heard around the world. Yes, there's always the official historical shot heard around the world in terms of the American Revolution, which changed everything in terms of a democracy for the world. But you know what? In the mid and early 50s, there was another shot heard around the world, and it was a wop bomb a loo bomb, a wop bam boom. And if you talk to Paul McCartney, and if you talk to Bob Dylan, and if you talk to Bruce Springsteen, and if you talk to Paul Simon, and if you talk to Mick Jagger, you talk to any of them, and you ask them, who was your inspiration? Who was one of your favorites? Little Richard is always named. Elton John, certainly in that group as well. Little Richard, the poor guy really didn't get as much, not even close to, the credit and still hasn't gotten the credit that he deserves. Probably because, sadly, at the time in a repressed era, as I said, of the 50s, where segregation was still very strong, here was a young black man who was stirring things up in a very white-dominated, repressed society, and so that wasn't going to fly. Many people like Pat Boone and others recorded his songs and made hits out of them and got played on the radio. And Little Richard, yes, he got some of his historical due, but he certainly never made the money he should have. He never really got the prestige. He's one of the initial, you know, first inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and his name is mentioned. But I guarantee if you talk to 100 people today and said, name me a Little Richard song, I don't know how many people could, and that's sad. But Little Richard, in my mind, more than Elvis. Yes, I know it's almost, but even more than Chuck Berry, who is credited as being the father of rock and roll. Elvis may have been the king of rock and roll, but many people attribute Chuck Berry as the greatest songwriter of rock and roll and the most influential songwriter of rock and roll, maybe the father of rock and roll. But in terms of a flashpoint moment of somebody who crystallized what rock and roll means, at least what it meant and what it still represents in a historical aspect, for me, it was Little Richard. And that one phrase, wop, bomba, luba, a wop, bam, boom, that says it all. Things are changing, folks. That is an expression of, that was in contrast to anything at the time. As I said, Steve Allen kind of mocking it, but at the same time, that comedy bit showed the mindset was, well, what is all this gibberish? We're used to well-crafted rhyming phrases and beautiful lyrical things like, strangers in the night exchanging glances and things like this. And all of a sudden, you've got some black guy from Georgia pounding on a piano with an energy and a fierceness never seen or heard of, and then putting one leg up on the piano and yelling at the top of his lungs, a wop bamba lubam, a wop bam boom. That starts the song. That is the rallying cry. That is the battle. That's the cry into war. Let's go. That's the shout of the beginning of the revolution. That was the shout heard around the world. Not the shot, but the shout heard around the world, in my view, is Little Richard singing a wop bamba lubam, a wop bam boom, tutti frutti, oh Rudy. Yeah, no. When dissected on paper, it does look like children's work. It looks like gibberish. But when performed, when sung, when felt, when experienced by not only the performer himself, but the audience, it changed the world. And so here we are, 70 years later. And yes, rock and roll is still around. It's certainly not the dominant music. It's not the dominant music on the radio. Yes, there's classic rock stations, but in terms of the charts, it's rap and hip hop and female oriented pop. And in all seriousness, it's probably been that way for the last 15 to 20 years, if not longer. In my view, I would actually say it's been closer to 30 years that rock and roll has pretty much been on the decline. Once Kurt Cobain died, I think for the most part, rock and roll died or at least began its slow death and eventual death. And it's not dead, but it's definitely, as I said many times here, it's on the ICU. And the only reason it's being kept alive is because of some of the originals, thanks to health and better living and medical technology. Many of rock's pioneers, like Paul McCartney, like Paul Simon, like Mick Jagger, like Pete Townsend, are still alive. They're in their 80s and they're still performing and they're still creating new music. Bob Dylan, don't let me forget Bob Dylan. They're still around. Bob Dylan, 84, 85 years old, still touring regularly. It's hilarious how Bob Dylan wrote, you know, the times are a changing, and he was telling the older generation to get out of the way. But he's not getting out of the way. The guy who said the times are a changing, get out of the way, get off the stage, let the youth take over. He's still out there. Be careful what you rebel against, because you become exactly that. You may have to eat your words. But what I really wanted to talk about today is that I've been saying this over the last 10 years. I mentioned in the beginning, this is now the 10th. We are now in the 10th year of this podcast. In May of 2016, I recorded my first podcast, and it was posted on May 24th, in fact. So this week is my 10th anniversary. And I will be discussing that in the next couple of podcasts to come. But this, to me, I just wanted to be a little more timely. I mean, anniversaries are anniversaries, and that's fine. But I wanted to be a little timely because this really struck me, and I wanted to make sure that I was talking about it when it was timely. I'm always about getting you information and being topical. And so, Jim, how come you're not celebrating your 10th anniversary with this podcast? Well, don't worry about it. As I told you many times, my birthday is January 8th, but because it's exactly 2 weeks after Christmas and 1 week after New Year's, many times, most of the times, between Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, my mom said, we can't keep celebrating with these same people. And so, you know, almost four times in a month and a half, every couple of weeks. And so my birthday parties, at least for my family and things, used to always be at the end of January just to give people a break. So while I commemorate my birthday, you know, it's just a date. So yeah, happy 10 years. I'm happy to do it. I'm excited. I'm proud that the fact that I'm still doing this every week, I've never missed a week. And for those who have been around, but we'll talk about that later. But yeah, I acknowledge it. This is the 10th anniversary. And thanks to Craig for letting me know that, in fact, because I didn't even remember. Back then, 10 years ago, when my first podcast appeared, I knew the date then, but I didn't think it'd be important. I certainly didn't think I'd be doing it 10 years later, to be honest with you. At that time, podcasts weren't even that big of a deal. They were just beginning, really. But anyway, back to what I was talking about. We'll talk about that in the coming weeks. But what I wanted to bring up about this whole kind of rock and roll and where it is now is because, and I've said this before, but now it is even more true because I've been saying it for the last 10 or 15, 10 and 5 years, and yet here we are still with some of those main names, Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, Bob Dylan, Pete Townsend. These people, Brian Wilson just died. Those people were huge in elevating rock and roll. Yes, those pioneers of the 50s, your Chuck Berrys, your Elvis Presleys, your Little Richards, your Jerry Lee Lewis's, your Fats Dominoes, you can't deny, and others, you can't deny their initial pioneering efforts. But it really wasn't until the Beatles in 1964 that rock and roll cemented itself into our culture. And as I said, it went on pretty much until the mid-90s, a good 30 years, almost 30 years exactly, because I believe that Kurt Cobain died in 1994 and the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan in 1964. But after that, after Kurt Cobain died, that opened the door for the pop music, the divas. Because as much as grunge was the, and alt rock was the music of the moment in the early 90s, especially grunge, it was too loud. It was too aggressive. Grunge at the end of the day was a mix of pop and speed metal and heavy metal. And at the end of the day, you know what? It was a cool sound. It was revolutionary. There's no doubt. It's why it rose, and certainly the visions of it in the images on MTV with the slacker grunge look of just t-shirts and ripped jeans and sneakers as a rebellion against the glam rock and the excesses of 70s rock. That's what it all was. And 80s rock, that's what it was. It was a rebellion against that. Rock has always been a rebellion. Music is always a rebellion against the status quo. But the problem with grunge was it could never have been a long-term musical genre because it was too hard, too rough, too aggressive. And at the end of the day, the mainstream, they like to dance. Let's face it. There was the big disco wars in the 70s, but you know what? Even though rock and roll supposedly won the disco wars, they really didn't. Because by the early 80s, there was dance music back. Within a couple, 3 years, disco demolition was in 1979, and by 1982, dance music was back. Just check the charts. It was a different name. They didn't use the D word. It wasn't disco anymore. That didn't have a good name. That didn't have a good connotation, but it was still dance music. Dirty dancing in the 80s was a phenomenon. It was all dance music. Let's hear it for the boys. And all that other kind of dance music. The safety dance, even New Wave and British Invasion, the second British Invasion, was really dance music with the synthesizers. Duran Duran, it was dance music. Women especially, young women, all women, they like to dance. Yeah, there's a contingent who will raise their fist at a hard rock show, but most women like to dance. Go to any wedding. Women are dancing with each other because men won't dance. But men like to go to where the women are, so they go to the dance places. But that's what gave birth to Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and later Taylor Swift and Katy Perry and the divas of today and Mariah Carey's. It was a rebellion, or it was a need for the mainstream, mainly women, to say, okay, this is cool, but I want to dance. Big bands, going back to the 20s, going back to the roaring 20s. Women dancing, the Charleston, the flappers. Then the dance halls, the Bobby Soxers. In Chicago here, the Paradise Ballroom, the Aragon Ballroom, these were dances. Big bands, Glenn Miller, Artie Shaw. Big bands, dancing, 50s, rock and roll, dancing. The Twist, the Stroll. The Peppermint Twist. Dancing. Let's dance. Let's dance. It's dancing. In the 60s, it was the Beatles. The girls were screaming. And they were dancing. And they were moving. And then in the 70s, rock got a little hard, a little rough. Your Zeppelins and all that stuff. But what were some of the biggest hits in the early 70s, before disco? Crocodile Rock, a dance song, dancing. And then disco came, and it was an explosion. And as I said, then Dirty Dancing in the 80s, dance music. And then in the 90s, Britney Spears, Mariah Carey, and now Taylor Swift, dancing. People like to dance. Women like to dance. Guys like women. It's a very, guys go where the women go. It's a long-held equation. It's the birds and the bees, folks. And we need some background music. And it's mostly dance music. And so rap has a beat. Hip hop has a beat. Women are dancing to it. Now men are dancing to it. Now men dance as much, if not more, than women. It's dancing. But rock and roll, in its purest form, is still around. Hip-hop, rap, pop, you know, female-oriented pop, yes, dominant on the charts. But because of the fact that people like Bob Dylan and Paul McCartney, and, you know, Paul Simon, and Mick Jagger, and others are still around, well, it's still in the headlines. It's still in the news. And so even though their records don't sell like they used to, even close to it, but because of simply being around, still being around, they get a lot of publicity. And yes, the first weeks when a new album by Paul McCartney comes out, in fact, I believe this week, Paul McCartney's album will be coming out, which is why I was trying to be timely here. New Paul McCartney, I think the new Stones album comes out in July. Ringo Starr just put out a new album. There's talk of Pete Townsend, who for the last 40 years has been breaking the Who up every 10 years, is talking about new Who music. He's been distancing himself from the Who for 50 years almost. And yet he's still talking about making new Who music, even though there's just him and Roger Daltrey left. But my point is, there's still a crowd. There's still an audience for it. When the Stones tour, I don't know if they'll ever tour again, just because of perhaps Keith Richards' physical abilities. But Paul Simon is on tour this summer. He'll be here in Chicago at Ravinia, two shows. Paul McCartney just did a tour. The Rolling Stones just did one a couple years ago. Ringo is on tour. Bruce Springsteen, I just saw Bruce Springsteen last week in Pittsburgh. Sold out house, everybody going crazy. Bruce Springsteen, 76 years old. Bob Dylan, still selling out shows, still performing at almost 85. So they're still around. They made fun of people back in, 30 or 40 or 50 years ago who were only in their 40s, but they won't give up the stage. And they alone are keeping rock and roll alive. It's now pretty certainty within the next 10 years, many of those names that I just mentioned, sadly, Paul McCartney, Bob Dylan, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Ringo Starr, Bruce Springsteen, Pete Townsend, Roger Daltrey, Bob Dylan, most of these people in the next 10 years, if they're not passed away, they most likely will not ever be performing again. And when they go, when there are no more concerts to go to, when it's just the music, then it'll be interesting to see how rock and roll as a musical genre then sits in our culture. Because right now, your Dylans and your McCartneys and your Simons and your Bruces and your Townsends and others like that, and your Dylans, are keeping it alive because they're alive. When they go, then just the music sits. And it'll be interesting to see how then just the musical body of music, of rock and roll, then carries on. If you think about the past, in classical music, we say, oh, well, there was Mozart and Bach and Beethoven, and then there was, and others, don't get me, I'm not denigrating anyone else. And then there's Chopin and other people like that. Okay, three or four of those. When we think about great operas, we think of Verdi. We think of Puccini. And then there was other writers, but, you know, one or two or three names. We think of big bands. As I said before, we think of Glenn Miller. We think of Artie Shaw. And then we mentioned some other ones that had, you know, but there's a few names. We think of early rock and roll, as I said before. We think of Chuck Berry. We think of Elvis Presley. We think of Little Richard. We think of Jerry Lee Lewis. And there was many more, but then it sort of goes away. And so here we are now in today's world with the people in their 70s and 80s remembering these people. Paul McCartney is 82 or 83 years old. Ringo Starr is 84, 85, 86. Bob Dylan, 84, 85. Mick Jagger, 81, 82. I mean, these guys are all in their 80s now. So that's their peer group. And the question now will be, when it's just the music, when they're not around to get the flash bulbs and the PR, when they're physically not here, then what happens? And that's the difference of what I wanted to really talk about, is the difference between relevancy, which is in the moment, and legacy. Now, what you would think that if you're an artist, you always want to be relevant. You always want to be moving forward in your moment while you're alive. But then there comes a point when you also want to say, okay, you know, you have to come to the realization of mortality. And then you say, well, what's my legacy going to be? What's my legacy? How will I be remembered? That's what the big question is. Well, how do you want to be remembered? It's all about legacy. So when you're younger, it's about relevancy. When you're older, it's about legacy. What will you leave? How you will be remembered? In art, there's Picasso, and there's Cezanne, and there's Gauguin, and there's Van Gogh. But there is a lot, and there's Monet and Matisse and people like this. There were hundreds of other artists, but we focus on the masters. And so what's going to be interesting to see is 100 years from now, who are considered the masters of the rock era? It has to be the Beatles. It has to be Bob Dylan. It has to be the Rolling Stones. But then I don't know, does the Who get in there? It should be Simon and Garfunkel and Paul Simon, at least in the 60s. But you never know. Does history allow more than three or four to be remembered? We'll see. Relevancy versus legacy. And what I've been observing now over the last several years, as all of these aging rock stars refused to leave the stage. They made fun of Frank Sinatra. They mocked Dean Martin. They mocked Tony Bennett when those guys were in their 40s, saying, get off the stage. Bob Dylan, leave. The times are a-changing. And now they don't want the times to change. And their audiences don't do either. I just went to Pittsburgh to see Bruce Springsteen. He came to Chicago in April, but I was out of town, so I missed the show. I haven't missed a Bruce Springsteen tour since 1980. That's 46 years. I've seen them about 64, 65 times now. I've never missed a tour. And when I went to that concert, there were people my age and older. Yes, a few young ones, but for the most part, it was people my age, a little younger, and many of them even older. More Bruce's age is even older than Bruce, who's 76. But they filled a 20-seat stadium in Pittsburgh. And they were on their feet, maybe not as much as they used to be, but they were, and there were young people there too, don't get me wrong, but the majority of the crowd was older. Rock and roll and music meant something to this generation, and the performers and the audiences are still clinging to it in their 60s, in their 70s, in their 80s. The person on the stage and the people in the seats don't want to let it go, whether it is a delusionary rejection of aging or a delusionary rejection of mortality, whatever it is, they want to cling to that. They're bringing back memories. They're staying what? Relevant, at least in their mind. They're still going to concerts. They remember their grandparents in their 70s and 80s, and their grandparents didn't even leave the backyard. But there were people in their 70s and 80s, because I saw them and heard them, they flew across the country or drove across the country to come to that concert in Pittsburgh. Relevancy, at least in their world, it's relevancy. We think about legacies. We think about how we want to be remembered. Certainly, if you're an artist of some great note, you want to leave a legacy behind and be remembered. But you know what I think's happening? The reason why all these rock stars who are in their 80s, late 70s and early 80s, why they won't leave the stage, why they keep making albums, even though only their diehard fans buy them, they might go up on the charts for a first week when all their fans run out and buy them, but by the second or third week, they fall off the charts and they're forgotten. They may get awards. They're obligatory at best. They're not making some of their best music. That we all know that. They all say this is one of my best albums ever because they're artists. They always want to feel that they're relevant. But we all know that for the most part, the creative spark for many people, artists in general, are in their 20s and 30s. Although I have to say, I just was in Pennsylvania when I went to Pittsburgh. I went to a Frank Lloyd Wright designed house called Falling Water in the outskirts of Pittsburgh. And I was shocked to see or learn that this beautiful, perhaps one of his most famous and most beautiful designed homes, Frank Lloyd Wright was 67 when he designed that. Wow, that gave me a jolt. But my point is relevancy. Stay relevant. Artists always want to stay relevant. There was a time when they thought about legacy, but what I think's happening is that these rock stars, these legendary rock stars, no question, legendary, their names should, and I think to some extent will live on for centuries, but we'll see. Well, I guess we won't, but time will tell. We won't be able to verify it. But yes, will Paul McCartney's name live on 100 years from now? I believe so. Will Bob Dylan's name live on 100 years from now? I believe so. Will Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones' name live on 100 years from now? I believe so. Will Bruce Springsteen's name? I believe so. Will Elton John's name? I believe so. Will The Who? I hope so. Will Paul Simon and Garfunkel? They better. They should. They deserve it. But I don't know. I don't know if history has enough space for as many people. I mean, even think about the Renaissance, one of the greatest eras in all of art. And yet, but whose names do we think about when we think about Renaissance artists? Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo. Yes, there were hundreds of others, and we see their works. Go to Italy, you'll see Caravaggio and other people. You'll see all these other different people's works. But when we think of the Renaissance, the first two names that come to our minds are Da Vinci and Michelangelo. For some reason, history likes to condense. They like cliff notes. And so it's going to be interesting to see who makes the rock and roll cut when it comes to history. And I think that the longer that these current rock stars who are still alive are looking around and they're saying, you know what? There was a time when I worried about my legacy, what I'd be remembered for. But you know what? I'm looking around and I'm seeing people like Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett or George Gershwin or Little Richard or Elvis Presley, who those people considered legends and influences, and the Mount Rushmores of rock. And these people today, your McCartneys and your Bruces or your Paul Simons or your Mick Jaggers, are looking around and saying, history today, people don't know those people like they should, or we thought the way they should. As I said before, go up to 100 people and ask them to name a Little Richard song. Can they do it? Can they name a George Gershwin song? They should be able to, but they don't. And so when we're looking now, if you were a Paul McCartney or a Paul Simon or a Mick Jagger, you know what? At one time, your legacy was important, but if you still can, If you physically can get up and do it, I think today's rock stars are going, you know what? I can't count on history to remember me. And not only that, but I won't be around when history remembers me. If I'm still able to get up on a stage and perform at some level, and there's an audience out there who wants to see me, even if I'm a rock and roll statue to them, even if I'm just there as a symbol of their youth, even if my voice isn't as strong, even if my playing isn't as strong, if I'm able to stand on that stage under that spotlight, and if there are 20,000 people on a nightly basis who still want to come out, who want to travel across the world or the country or wherever to come and see me, then I will do it, because at least I'm experiencing it for myself. I want to be relevant while I'm around. I can't count on my legacy. I can't count on history. I can do whatever I can to make sure I'm remembered, but then that's out of my hands. Right now, I still have control of my image, of my relevancy. If there's still 20,000 people in 40 cities that want to see me every night, I'm still relevant to some people, and I want to experience that. Don't forget, you're Bob Dylan's, you're Paul McCartney's, you're Paul Simon's, you're Bruce Springsteen's, you're Ringo Starr's, you're Barry Manilow's, you're Pete Townsend's, you're Elton John's, you're Bruce Springsteen's. For 50 or 60 years, these people have had that adoration and that attention that has been bestowed on very few people. Like that kind of adoration, as well as the billions that they've made collectively. That's hard to give up. If you've been living on private planes and mansions, and you've never written out your telephone bill or your electric bill in 50 years, that's a whole different world. And it's hard to go back into a world of obscurity, because you don't remember being obscure anymore. If your life has been in the spotlight and an adoration for 50 years, you don't remember what it's like not to be famous. You don't remember what it's like to be obscure. And while they still can do it, to what level, that's a question, they're going to do it. I think they're more worried about relevancy in today, while they're alive, then they worry about their legacy. They're like, you know what? If they can forget about Sinatra, if they can forget about Gershwin, if they can forget about Mozart, if they can forget about Bach, then they could probably forget about me. So you know what? I'm going out until I can't do it anymore, until I leave. There used to be this thing about, you know, leave gracefully. You don't see that happening, because I think what we've seen is today's world has very little appreciation, very little acknowledgement, and very little interest in the past. We are much more about today and relevancy right now. We are a 5-minute attention span society, and we don't care what came after us. That's yesterday's news. And so while these people should be historical figures, there's no guarantees they will be. So you know what? They're going to experience it and take whatever relevancy they can grab while they're still around. Even if they're in their mid-80s, even if their musical powers and their musical talents have declined greatly, if there's an audience to demand it, who still wants to see it, and they can still do it, they're doing it. The reason I bring this up is because in the last couple of weeks, there was a real big backlash against Paul McCartney's performance on Saturday Night Live. And I saw it. And yeah, the fact of the matter is, Paul McCartney's voice is shot. It's shot. It's been shot for several years. I saw him about 10 years or so ago at Wrigley Field, and it was a great concert, and he was still in good voice. But the man is 83, 84, whatever he is. There's no studio tricks anymore. When you can't do that. He's got, you know, when you're on that microphone, it's there. Paul McCartney's voice is shot, but it doesn't matter. While a lot of people are saying, oh, my God, this was embarrassing. Go away, Paul. Your voice is shot. Oh, you know, there were others that said, he's a Beatle. He can do whatever he wants. I just want to see Paul McCartney. And Paul McCartney wants to be seen. Paul McCartney wants to be heard. He has been at the center of the universe since 1964. That's 62 years. He doesn't want to give up the stage. Bob Dylan, his voice is croaking. He doesn't even look at the thing, but he wants to be out there. He is used to being a troubadour and performing and singing music. And he doesn't want to give it up, even if his talents are not what they used to be. If people still want to see it, they'll do it. Paul Simon just put out a new album a couple of years ago. His voice certainly is much weaker than it used to be. And his hearing was bad. He thought he couldn't even tour anymore. Now that's cleared up. He's out on a tour. He's selling out. People want to see history. To some extent, see these legends. They are legends. We're all about the moment now. Whether you're 20 or 40 or 60, everybody wants to say, I saw that person. Yeah, I saw Frank Sinatra perform. Sadly, I never saw Elvis Presley perform. But I saw Frank Sinatra perform. I saw many of the greatest perform. I saw Tony Bennett perform. If you're a fan of that, that means something. You were able to see something that does have some importance, some special talent. Even after you're gone, those memories will be gone, but you have them, your relevant memories. We're seeing that history has, for the most part, history has a short memory, at least in today's world. It didn't used to. But it seems in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years or even 30 years, our recognition of history is less, I guess, sacred than it used to be. And in many ways, we're trying to change history or at least flesh it out. Many of the legends and heroes of the past centuries are now being shown as being less than heroic. I mean, one of the most obvious was, I said, a few weeks ago, Christopher Columbus, completely. He had a 400-year run of being one of the most respected people in the history of mankind. And over the last 15 or 20 or 30 years, now he's looked at as a villain in many people's eyes. He had a good 400-year run, but it didn't last. So is Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr and George Harrison and John Lennon, are they going to have a 400-year run? I don't know. People, sadly, are already forgetting John Lennon. And that was only 45 years ago, 46 years ago, that he was assassinated. There's no guarantees of what history will remember of you, regardless of what you did. There's no guarantees of the legacy, that how your legacy will be viewed. So you know what? You do what you have to do. Paul McCartney's voice is shot. No question. But people still want to see a Beatle. Ringo Starr puts out a new album, goes out. People still want to see a Beatle. Bob Dylan's voice has been shot for years. They still want to see the guy who wrote The Times Are A-Changin' and Like a Rolling Stone, even if he won't even sing it anymore. It's Bob Dylan. People still want to see Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend say, I hope I die before I get old, which now is impossible. They still want to say, we won't get fooled again. They still want to see Mick Jagger saying, give me shelter, or let's spend the night together, or start me up. They still want to hear Paul Simon sing Song of Silence, or Still Crazy After All These Years. And I can attest to this because I just saw it a couple of weeks ago. They still want to hear Bruce Springsteen sing Born to Run. Now, the interesting thing about Bruce Springsteen, which really, to me, solidifies this relevancy versus legacy. I mean, Bruce Springsteen now is being lauded as the greatest, you know, essential of the America's Poet Laureate of Rock and all this stuff. All this is being heaped. I mean, once again, the older you get, the more awards you get, the more accolades you get. But we'll see what happens in 100 years. But right now, he's in the midst of, he's just ending, in fact, a 20-city tour which is really something very different for him. As I said, I haven't missed a Bruce Springsteen tour since 1980. So I've seen it from when he was still in his late 20s, early 30s to now when he's 76 years old. Okay. I mean, it's 46 years that I've seen him. He was maybe 29 or 30 the first time I saw him. He may have just turned 30. Yeah, he just turned 30. I saw him in November of 1980. So just as when he was 30 and now he's 76, and I've seen him every time he's toured for the last 46 years. And I think that his latest tour is what made me think about this topic. This tour was about Bruce Springsteen regaining his relevancy. Yes, he's getting a lot of accolades now and legacies, and he's building this Bruce Springsteen musical foundation in his hometown in Asbury Park and all this stuff. But for the artist himself, as I said before, that's about history. But for the artist himself, there's nothing more important today, at least, I think, than relevancy. And the remaining aging rock stars are desperate and craving relevancy. They know that the rock genre is not what it used to be, but they also know that there's a group of people, their fans, who are still demanding it, and it's in their bodies. They gave up their whole lives to this. This was their cause. So they can't walk away from this. For them, rock and roll wasn't just a job. It was a life. It was a life choice. It was a lifestyle. They just can't walk away from it. They want to be relevant. So this current tour that he's doing right now, called the Land of Hope and Dreams Tour, is basically, in many ways, a very overt political rally. I mean, that's what it is. Yes, he sings Born to Run. Yes, he sings The Promised Land. Yes, he sings Hungry Heart. But the foundation and the songs chosen are very overtly political, and he makes no bones about, and he doesn't pull any punches. He is an anti-Trump protester. His rhetoric is aggressive and hyperbolic and determined. At times, I went to the concert. It sounds like, you know, right out of the playbook. It sounds like it's MSNBC with the E Street Band behind it. That's his choice. But I think the reason that he went out on this tour was more about relevancy than about his legacy. Because he's not playing Rosalita. He's not playing Jungle Land. He's not playing Backstreets. He's not playing, Thunder Road. Those are his legacy songs. He's playing songs that he's written through his career that have had social and protest leanings toward them. Bruce Springsteen has always been political. There's no question about that. He was involved with the No Nukes concert in the late 70s. He was a part of the Amnesty International tour in the 80s. He did several concert tours for Democratic presidential candidates like John Kerry. I went to see that in Detroit back in the early 90s, what year was that? Probably when did John Kerry run? I can't remember anymore. but you know, for Hillary Clinton, for Kamala Harris. He played at Barack Obama's inauguration. He's done podcasts with Barack Obama. Since his 1981 tour, he has regularly had food depositories and for the homeless and for the hungry, have set up shop at their at his concerts, asking people to donate. He's always been politically active. But this tour is so, but it's always been a soft sell. Even in concert, He's made some political statements, and his songs, he let his music do the talking. But this time, he's actually focusing less on his music doing the talking and more on himself doing the talking. Within the show, he does about three or four very pointed, very aggressive, very passionate, anti-Trump, Democrat. There's no question of where Bruce Springsteen stands. And that's what's new. That's what's new. He's always been socially relevant and socially aware, and his music has written that too, but he's never been so overt as this tour. And to be honest with you, it seems that it wasn't. I've seen him. I mean, he's one of the greatest performers of all time. That's why I've traveled from coast to coast to see him. There are very few performers who can generate the excitement and the loyalty and devotion of a crowd of 20,000 people in that moment. Very few like he can for 3 hours. It was a 3-hour show. He's 76 years old. He's still in good shape. His voice still sounds fairly strong. The E Street Band, Max Weinberg, I think he played one of the best drum solos in Born in the USA that I've ever seen him perform, and he's in his mid-70s. And I was on the tour, and I saw the tour here in Chicago, maybe the second show or third show of the tour in 1984 when the album first came out, when Max Weinberg played that drum solo for Born in the USA for the first time in concert, one of the first times. And I would argue that the version he did about a week or so ago on May 19th in Pittsburgh was better than the first one he did 45 years ago or 42 years ago. I would argue that. It was amazing. It was explosive. It set the tone for the concert. It energized Springsteen right at the beginning. It energized the whole band, and it was a very powerful show. But there's no question that this show, if Bruce Springsteen was political in the past, it was always kind of a soft sell, a little passive. But this time, it's out front. You walk into the lobby, and the merch, every T-shirt basically had a slogan of the anti-Trump, contingent. No kings. Save democracy. The Republic, United Freedom of the E Street Nation. I mean, it was there. Upside down flags. I mean, it was present. It was strong. The concert began with Springsteen coming out and giving a very aggressive rant, calling President Trump racist and ignorant. I mean, you name it. This was not a soft sell by any means. And it was interesting to see, because here I was in Pittsburgh, a relatively, you would think, blue-collar city, right? Based on the steel mills. You can't get much more blue-collar in Americana than Pittsburgh. But the fact of the matter is, we've had a political shift. The blue-collar workers are no longer automatically Democratic. They voted for Trump in the last election. Bruce Springsteen was spouting some very tough, very biased, very aggressive anti-Trump rhetoric. And what was interesting was, usually in a Bruce Springsteen concert, whenever, and sometimes they are like tent revivals, and they have in the past, and many times he's actually been like a preacher, and I've seen the place go up like it was one of those tent revivals, religious tent revivals from the 30s and 40s, because he was using his music and using his performance as a unifier. And his fans are as loyal as they can, and they idolize this guy, and anything he does, they love. But what was interesting to see was, in this setting, even in this city, his message was received, but it wasn't with that same kind of, he had to to coax them. And then, of course, their loyalty to him took over. And then when he played his hits, of course, the place, you know, whether it was Promised Land or whatever, everybody went nuts, as they always do in Born to Run. But when he was giving his political speeches, it wasn't 20,000 people screaming in unison. And that moment when I saw that, I realized for the first time, and it was kind of disappointing, for the first time, I felt like Bruce Springsteen's music and Bruce Springsteen himself, he was always a unifier. He let his music talk, and he used his performance as a unifying presence in times of trouble, in times of chaos. But for the first time, he definitely was taking a stand. There was no question about it. The set list was filled with politically influenced and socially influenced songs. Yes, he did some of his hits. He did Hungry Heart and he did Two Hearts and things like that. But for the most part, these songs were very scripted. What I felt, it was a powerful show. Don't worry. No doubt about that. The man can still command a room. There's no question about it. His charisma, his work ethic, his connection with his audience, it's still there. And his performance, still there. The E Street Band, as I said, everybody sounded great. They're all in their 70s, mid to late 70s, and they sound as powerful as ever. But what was kind of disappointing, which kind of took a little away from the show, was that it was so scripted because it was so dedicated to this anti-Trump message that what makes a Bruce Springsteen's show so exciting and so unlike anything else is the danger of it, is the unpredictability of it. I've been to so many shows, I've been right in the front, and I can see when he's performing and he hears the cheers, and all of a sudden, in the midst of, after a song, he will turn to Steve Van Zandt or to Max Weinberg, and he will call an audible. Whatever song was on the list, that's not next, because he's feeling the crowd, and he knows that that next song isn't going to take it to the next level, and so he calls an audible. And there were moments where there could have been an audible called, and to seize upon the frenzy of the crowd and the excitement of the crowd after a certain song, but he didn't do it. He stayed to his script because this was a different concert. This was something different for him. This was probably the most scripted show that he's ever done since his 1988 tour of The Tunnel of Love, which was another very specifically scripted show with very little, if any, at least initially. As time went on, he may have thrown in a few different songs, but it was the same set list every night. That is practically unheard of in his career. He always changes things up on a nightly basis. But now he's been playing the same because this is, in his mind, this is a show that he wants to get a message across, both not just with his music, but with his rants, his speeches. There's no question of what side he's on. And so to some extent, it was disappointing because for the first time, when I went to a Bruce Springsteen show, he was trying to unite. He professed to be wanting to unite, but it was impossible with what he was saying because it was so one-sided that if you didn't agree with him, and certainly people in the audience did not, you could feel it. It was palpable until he coaxed them on like, hey, you hear what I'm saying? Well, then, of course, they started to cheer just because it's Bruce saying it. So I guess, but the initial reaction was not some frenzied yes, like some tent revival. And so for the first time, Bruce Springsteen's concert was not a unifying experience. It wasn't an escape from the outside world, an escape from the chaos, an escape from the uncertainty. I assume Springsteen is, in his mind, is saying that he's trying to speak for the under the unspoken or the underdog or whatever. But we are in such a divided world right now. And his message was certainly not one of unity. Because if you were either, I mean, in today's world, you either like Trump or you hate Trump. That's what it is. But if you sit in the middle, you can't, you're viewed as a traitor by both sides. And there's no question which side Springsteen is on right now. But I question, where did this overt political stance come from? Most of the time, a Bruce Springsteen show has been about unity, about an escape from the chaos of the outside world, of bringing people of all different kinds together to celebrate his music. We're going to lock the doors, and we are just going to forget about the outside world for a while. But Bruce Springsteen, for the first time, in a very overt way, brought the outside world inside, and he'd never done that before. And it changed the tone. Yes, he played Born to Run. Yes, he played Promised Land. Yes, he played Dancing in the Dark. But the tone of the evening was different, because once some of those songs got done, he brought it back to a very overt political stance. And the songs he sang supported that. I give him credit for crafting a show like that. And that's his right to do whatever he wants. But as a longtime fan, for more than 50 years, or almost 50 years, the first time, it wasn't about the music. It was about some other message. And that was the first time that that ever happened. I liked when Bruce Springsteen let his music do the talking. And this time, he was doing the talking. And it was a very one-sided kind of perspective. It wasn't a unifying factor. He professed wanting unity, but he said we should aggressively but peacefully protest. Well, I don't know if peaceful and aggressive go together in the same sentence. And so that's where I think a lot of conflict within this show happens. When he started this tour, he was as vehement and anti-Trump as possible. Then he had to eat his words the second or third show in, because the president got shot at. There was an assassination attempt. And so then he had to backpedal a little. But now he's back. But once again, that was just in the moment, and now there's no backpedaling. And he's back to the very strong rhetoric. That's his choice. That's fine. I have no problems with him wanting to do that. That's his right to do it. But it's sad that he had to, I guess, ruin the concert experience. I mean, he could have gone out and done a speaking tour. But he brought this political one-sided into what used to be a very unifying experience of his concerts, and he made it divided now. And I think he did it for one reason. Rather than political advocacy, rather than his hate for Trump, I think he did it for relevance. Why? Well, let's look at the realities here. 2025 was not a very successful year for Bruce Springsteen. Probably one of the least successful of his career. In 2025, he put out a seven album set called Tracks 2, which was for his fans this holy grail. There's always been rumors since the mid 80s that Springsteen had done completed albums, and right before their release, they were pulled. Complete full albums. And so some of the songs would get released through bootlegs or other ways, but there was always these rumors and these talks about he made a country album and he made a hip hop album and he made this album and he made a crooner album, but we never heard any of it. They were all in the vaults. They were all pulled at the last second. And so if you're a Bruce Springsteen fan, this was the Holy Grail. What was this unreleased music that he recorded completely with different bands, fully completed, and then he didn't release? Oh my gosh, to hear that. Well, finally, now at age 75, at the time, just turned 76, he decided to open up the vaults and release his tracks to all these albums. And so at the beginning, there's a frenzy like it always is, where they, as I said before, with a legacy rock star, new music, new material, it gets press. But then it has to land, sit on its laurels. And after the diehard fans go out and buy it, the first week, it does well on the charts, and then it goes away. And that's exactly what happened to Trax. And you know what? Even the most diehard Springsteen fans, like myself, we listen to all of these albums, and it's not like one of these albums. I mean, the critics, of course, praised it because they always will. Once again, a legacy performer. The fact that he's doing anything, they give them the obligatory five-star review. But in reality, there were seven albums in this case, right? From the 80s to the 2000s. And I didn't hear one of those albums that I said, oh my God, why didn't he release this album? It would have been one of the best of his career. There were certain moments and certain songs across that set, but there wasn't one full album that I said, wow, this is a lost masterpiece. You know what? At the end of the day, those seven albums that were never released, smart move. None of them were a lost masterpiece. Some of them had some very good moments and some great songs, but as complete individual albums, not one of those seven really was a masterpiece. So for all the hype and all the expectations, Trax 2 kind of fell short. So then, what was happening in 2025? A movie was being made about Bruce Springsteen's life. Everybody bought the biopics now, right? Sure. Ever since Bohemian Rhapsody won the Academy Award, for Malick as Freddie Mercury. So, biopics. So, but what did Bruce Springsteen's camp do? Led by his manager, John Landau. Instead of doing a biopic about his life and ending at the pinnacle, say, during his Born in the USA, triumph in 1984, after a very tough, you know, personal life and even a tough career leading to that point, by his mid-30s, he finally made it. What a great story. No. They focus on a year and a half, and perhaps making his least commercial album of all, Atlantic City. They've tried to elevate it as this masterpiece, but it's him and his guitar. No Clarence Clemons, no E Street Band. And as much as they want him to become the Woody Guthrie, you know, his management and his camp, the fans want Born to Run. That's the Bruce Springsteen they want. They liked the Glory Days Bruce Springsteen song. So this very dark, sullen, emotionally, psychologically torn movie starring the guy from The Bear. I mean, they had everything except it was a very slogging, slow, depressing story. None of the exhilaration of a Bruce Springsteen, of what Bruce Springsteen's image is. There was a deliberate effort to make him this brooding, deep, tortured artist, as opposed to this liberating, exhilarating performer who connects with his audience. This was the exact opposite. I don't want to see my audience. I don't want to talk to my audience. And that's what they showed us for 2 hours. It was a slog. The movie failed tremendously. One of the biggest bombs ever. Fans didn't even go to see it. And on the heels of that, they released another Holy Grail, because apparently this Nebraska album from 1982, which was just Bruce and his guitar recorded very sparsely in his bedroom with an old kind of tape recorder, was initially demoed with members of the E Street Band as full productions. But Bruce at that time said, though, that's not the way those songs need to be heard. So that's been another Holy Grail, the electric version of Nebraska. Yes, we have this sparse, eerie, strange, guitar echoey version of Nebraska, but there was an electric version with the full band, and that's been, you know, a myth for years. Since it came out, Bruce told the story. I recorded with the band, and then I decided not to. And I had this cassette tape of the original recordings, my demos, in my pocket, and that's what we released. And that was the story for 40 years. Then he decides that, well, I don't even remember if there ever was an electric. He says, I don't remember there being an electric Nebraska. Well, of course there was. That was the story. And there was. I don't know what the point of that comment was, but then he released it. This is the Holy Grail for Bruce Springsteen fans. A movie, flop. Tracks, 7 albums ever released, flop. And then Nebraska comes out. The Electric Nebraska. And guess what? Diehards bought it, flop. No one cares. So in 2025, what should have been on paper a huge year for Bruce Springsteen turned out to be a very irrelevant year for Bruce Springsteen. And thus, in my view, why we have this somewhat impromptu tour. Why? Because I think Bruce Springsteen, after a very disappointing 2025, looked around and says, am I irrelevant? You know what gets me relevancy? When I go out and perform that's at the end of the day, he can always rely on a concert tour to bring the people back. The albums have always been hit or miss since Born in the USA, but nothing has ever matched from the beginning of his career his ability to perform in front of an audience. And he knows he can rely on that. So how does he erase his irrelevancy of 2025? He comes out of nowhere with a surprise tour. And then how does he increase his relevancy? He jumps on the anti-Trump rallying cry that's happening in the country today. And I really believe that one of the main influences of this tour is somebody who's on the tour, a guy named Tom Morello. People may know of him from Rage Against the Machine. He is very politically aggressive and active. He's a very socialist kind of performer. He makes no bones about it. His guitar says, arm the homeless. His guitar has the Russian flag on it. He is a very far left guy. And Springsteen embraced him several years ago, brought him on tour, and he's on this tour again. And he performed several times throughout the show with Bruce Springsteen. And I believe he even has his tour merchandise being sold next to Bruce Springsteen's. I think Bruce Springsteen was very influenced by Tom Morello and his political activism. I think that Bruce Springsteen saw a chance, because when you see people like Colbert and Kimmel getting the headlines of being anti-Trump and getting all that that relevancy, I think he saw Colbert. I think he saw Kimmel becoming these kind of high-profile, rebellious media darling, you know, certain aspects of the community being praised for free speech and being anti-Trump. Robert De Niro, same way. And so I think Springsteen said, how do I become relevant again in 2026? Well, first I have to get out on the road, but it's not just that. I need even more than that, because I'm 76 years old, and do people care anymore? You know what? I'm going to become a political activist, not just passively, but overtly. And so from a media standpoint, this tour has gotten a lot of great publicity. He's being anti-Trump. He's with that whole contingent there, but the fans are still coming. What I saw at this concert was the fans reacting to Bruce Springsteen's music still. They listened to his political rants, but they waited for the music. They wanted to hear. They had their fists up. Or in this case, I had to laugh while I was walking the concourse. I saw more people with canes at this concert than I ever saw, even in a nursing home. You know how you're at a concert and you raise your fist up? If you really look close, more people were raising up their canes during Born to Run than they were raising up their fists. It's a different experience, but the passion is still there. But I think that this show for Bruce Springsteen was more about relevancy than political activism. And to some extent, it's working. But I think it's more about relevancy than legacy. The aging rock stars crave relevancy. They don't want to count on history keeping them alive. While they're alive, while they're capable, while they're able to stand on a stage for a couple of hours, they will do it. Their voices may be diminished. Their musical capabilities may not be what they were. It's not in the case of Bruce Springsteen, for sure. But people like Paul McCartney and Ringo never had a great voice anyway, and other people like that. Yes, they're old. They're 85. They shouldn't be expected to sound and look the same way they did when they were 25. But they want to remain relevant. I think they're saying, you know what? I'll take relevancy over legacy any day. I want to keep feeling that connection while I can. And so like a classic baby boomer, they never not want to be in the spotlight. They never want to give up the stage. Reality and mortality will ultimately win. But as it stands right now, rock and roll, as long as some of their legends are alive, rock and roll is still alive. The expiration date is coming more quicker now than ever. But as it stands right now, rock and roll is still alive. For the time being, long live rock, at least for another 5 years. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Of course, you can always go out and tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 522. I'm Jim Tarano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic for 10 years now, from the end of my mind to your ears.